Okay. Well, I have two very special people to introduce. First of all, is that one of the most beautifully photographed films that you've ever seen? The cinematographer whose work we've seen at the museum with Pariah and Middle of Nowhere. He also shot Ain't Them Body Saints and A Most Violent Year this year. He's one of the best cinematographers working today. Please welcome Bradford Young. What can I say about Ava DuVernay? She was here a few years ago showing Middle of Nowhere. I didn't realize she'd be back so quickly with this amazing film. It's a real thrill to have her back. This is actually the last day in a retrospective of her films. She has been making films for 6 years and already earned a retrospective. She's amazing. Ava DuVernay. Well, congratulations to both of you for this amazing film, the amazing ride it's been having so far. And I just wanted to start, before we get into the discussion, I want to acknowledge two people in the audience, because you, at the New York premiere of your film, you and I think some of your crew are wearing shirts that said, I can't breathe. And this film is so timely. You have a reference to Ferguson in the film, and in New York, what happened to Eric Garner and the protests afterwards were in everybody's minds recently, and Eric Garner's daughter and sister, his daughter Erica and sister Lesha are here in the audience. So all of our thoughts are with you, and I know that I looked on Erica's website because she's been very involved in leading a lot of the peaceful protests, which are modeled a lot on what Dr. King did, and Martin Luther King is on her Twitter page as the main image, so hope you like the film. So I understand that you were first involved with Selma when it was a different kind of project, and you were called to maybe do some consulting work. Is that true? Back in the day when you were doing marketing, and I think other directors were attached to this film, so could you talk about like your first involvement with Selma?
Well, hi, folks. You all look beautiful. Don't they have a nice light on them, Bradford? Wouldn't you like to light photograph them? I used to be a publicist, and so I got a call from some French people one day asking if I would come on board as a publicist for a film that they were doing called Selma with Lee Daniels as the director. This was maybe, I want to say 4 years ago, maybe. And I still have a contract where I made a deal with Pathé to be the publicist for Selma. little did we know at that time. It's funny how life changes, and you, for better or worse, just have to go with the flow of it. This is before I was, seriously making films, just kind of dabbling in it, and it came back around in a different way.
Your filmmaking career has been so extraordinary, because we just looked at all your films, and it's really 6 years of filmmaking, and you've done three feature films and documentaries and short films, and it's just been an amazing ride. But Middle of Nowhere, for which you won the Best Director Award at Sundance, was made for a fraction of the budget of this film. So what was it? What did it mean to you to think about making Selma? There hadn't been a feature film with Dr. King as the main character. This is all daunting, I would think.
Oh, no, not daunting.
Okay. To other people, it might be.
Not daunting. I mean, Bradford and I made Middle of Nowhere. It was $200,000. And this film was $20 million.
So that's 100 times. That's 100 times the budget, if I'm doing my math correctly.
It's a jump. But, when you're making a $20 million film that requires as many set pieces as we had, as much period costume as we had, as much as huge a cast as we had. I mean, to give context, the interview cost $44 million. And so $20 million for this kind of film is very much an independent. We made it outside of the studio system. It's being distributed by Paramount Pictures, but it was made independently, financed by French financiers, Pathé. So so the spirit on the set was still very much what we're used to, which is get it done. You know what I mean? Not enough hours to get all the pages? Get it done. He looks at me like, well, what's... Let me just go ahead and do it. I don't know what you're doing. We just talk. I say that. Yeah, I got it. We're going to do it. So we have a shorthand, and our shorthand has really been built on limits. You know what I mean? Trying to find the creativity within certain bounds, and most of those boundaries have been financial. But just kind of breaking through that and still trying to find, you know, the space where we can tell our stories the way we want. And so it felt not daunting. It felt like something we were used to me. Hmm. And something we embraced, because I think different from some of the other directors who'd been attached, and there had been like six other people before I came on board, these were filmmakers that were used to making films at a certain price point with a certain type of resources. And I was never used to that. So it wasn't anything that I needed in order to find the story or anything that I wanted even. I was very happy making films for the price point that I had. So so yeah, not daunting. What do you think?
No, I mean, it's just funny at that level how the money, it's, you demystify the money very quickly because you realize that most of that money we're not seeing anyway.
It's not coming to us anyway.
You know what I mean? It's like I'm operating with the same amount of crew. I brought all the same cats from the $200,000, $80,000 movie days. And you know, you develop a sort of ethos around making films in a low budget world that you kind of works, and you don't want to sort of break the mold or break the form. You know, and so for me, it wasn't about the sort of reinventing ourselves with the money, because I'm not seeing the money anyway. It felt as tough and as you know, impacted as much as it would be on a $200,000 movie. So,
well, in a way, I one of the things I love about this movie is that it has the intimacy that your films all have. I mean, that is what I love about your other movies, that they're intimate in scale. And so you made a film that is not the typical historical biopic type of film. I mean, so in a way, your approach, you know, and maybe your, I don't know if your limits helped you in a way, but this is a film and a piece very similar to your other films in its intimacy.
Well, that's good. I mean, I didn't want to make something that, I mean, look, this was a jump. It was about Martin Luther King. I mean, for Black people, I mean, look, my father's from the South. My grandmother had pictures on the wall of Jesus and Dr. King at equal height on the wall. Like, that's, you know, the myth and the feeling around Dr. King and the African American community in the South, certainly of a certain generation. And so you come up with that, you're invited to make a film about Dr. I mean, really? I mean, why not just, I mean, who else could, really? Martin Luther King Jr.? And so now in hindsight, it's done. And it's like, wait, that worked. But at the moment when someone hands you that project, you're like, yeah. Lord, have mercy. Really, what the hell are we gonna do? And so really, it was just about finding what was interested in it, what we were interested in about it. And for me, it was really about deconstructing heroes. Mm. I mean, I'm not interested in, you know, congratulating or comforting anyone about anything, really. And so, you know, whether it's MLK or LBJ or whoever it is, you know, it's really about understanding that there are gray areas within all of us, and you know, the complexities of human nature. No relationship is all perfect in a skip in the park. Yeah. Things are complicated, things are messy, and so, and King, you know, I mean, King has been reduced for many of us, most of us. We know him as I Have a Dream. He believed in peace, and he was murdered. Mm-hmm. Really, there's not a lot of nuance to what most people know, most Americans know, about who he was, a radical, a charismatic, a dynamic, who was, you know, you're just out of the box thinker, you know, a leader of leaders. Everyone around him was a leader. Hmm. He wasn't necessarily the only one who could have done what he did. He was the only way who could have done it in the way that he did. He was the best speaker. He was, you know, an orator, and his oration is what raised him up above not above, but kind of to lead the groups that he was in charge of at that moment. And so I think that, you know, getting into that texture, the personal relationships, the fact that black people and the way we think about these issues are not a monolith, the fact that white people and the way white people think about these issues are not all the same. Just trying to show an array of it. I figured, I told Bradford at one point, look, they've given us this movie about Dr. King. Let's just go for it the way we want to do it. Because either they're going to like it or they won't like it. If they don't like it, at least we know we did it our way. Right. Truly. Right. You know, I mean, it was a big test. You remember?
Oh, yeah.
Just like, let's just try.
Yeah.
Well, you had David Oyelowo at the beginning. I mean, did he bring the project to you or recommend you? I mean, his performance is just, extraordinary.
Yeah, David brought the project to me. We had worked together in the middle of nowhere. He had been cast by Lee Daniels in the previous version of Selma by Lee Daniels. And so when that project fell apart, he was an actor without a director, an actor without a film, basically. Mm. And so he did with most actors I hope will follow suit and do, which is self-determine. He started calling around. He started to try and to marshal all these producers in France, in the UK, in America, this international group of producers toward one goal. Let's make this picture. What do we need to do it? They say we feel like there needs to be an African-American director. We've gone through Spike, we've gone through Lee. We feel like, you know, the price point is such that it needs to be someone emerging. We need to wait for someone to emerge. He's like, yo, I just work with this. She right here. And and so he starts campaigning for me, and he gives the middle of nowhere, and they don't watch right away. And he calls, and he says, have you watched it? No, and he calls back a week later, have you watched it? And he badgered them, and he wrote emails, and he called.
Wow.
And he's doing all this before I know that he's doing any of it. Mm. And so, you know, but the idea that an actor is going to, you know, really kind of take the reins of a project, he really is the rainmaker of this. He brought this together. He brought on Miss Winfrey. Those are the director and the producer that breathed life into the project is pretty weighty stuff. So this is all, we're here because of Dave. He brought us together. We had worked together before. We hadn't worked together in a while. We didn't know if we were going to work together again. Brad was going off and doing fancy projects. I was still just scraping together small indies is basically what was happening. He was working with JC on Fancy Movies and Ed Zwick, and I was still just trying to make another $200,000 film. I was, you know, things happened, and they worked together on Most Violent Year. And David called me and was just like, you and Bradford, what's going on? You two, you need to talk. You need to get this going. So he did. We haven't ever acknowledged that in public, but
he
brought us together again. So it was all David. Shh. It's all David.
So what were your discussions like? I understand that you had certain photographs in mind, the photographs of the Robert F. Kennedy.
What? Paul Fusco.
Yeah, the photographs of people waiting for the train carrying Robert Kennedy. Yeah. But there was a certain look you had in mind. Could you talk about your discussions? Because it's just such a visually extraordinary movie.
Well, you know, the Paul Fusco photographs are just sort of, I think, the trickle down of other conversations that Abe and I had. I mean, our process is sort of, on all the things that we've worked on together, inevitably what happens is that we get in a room and we start talking about the movie, and like 15 minutes into the conversation talking about the film, like it turns into a whole nother conversation that doesn't have anything that's not really related to the film, but is absolutely related to the film. And so, you know, once I finally got in the room with Ava, it was clear that she had done all this research. I wasn't in conversation, we hadn't talked, so it was like all this research she had done, all this stock footage she was showing me. So it was already like a sort of idea around what the film could be, and it didn't want to be a film that sort of mirrored things that we've seen already of the time, but it also wanted to be respectful of the things that we've seen of the time. Obviously, we're students and we're children of the movement, and that's very much part of our own sort of collective consciousness why we make films. You know, that time is very dear to us. So I think we've already been inundated with those images, just the same way Ava didn't want to be. She didn't want to approach this film in sort of a sentimental way as the sort of historical biopic drama. That was very clear. Like, that's not the film I want to make, bro. Like, I don't want to make that movie. I want to do what we would do in our version, you know? And so visually it was the same thing. It's like, we have all these images, but how can we challenge ourselves in a way to make it fresh, and make it, I think, more than anything, the Paul Fusco photographs are just sort of the patina on the film. I think the patina on the film, you can demystify that real quick. You can put that in your laptop, turn a couple of knobs, and you can get that. I think what was really, really the sort of the undercurrent is this idea of, as much as Ava was invested in making sure that we sort of demystify King in a particular way and kept the in our perspective in terms of story on him very nuanced, is like the film had to be an active, the camera had to be an active participant. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to feel like this was our uncle, this was our cousin, this is a guy we know just on his a porch smoking a cigarette, writing a letter to his wife. You know, those were more, for me, were more juicy and more meaty than just the actual patina of the film. And then Ava, as we sort of developed that conversation, 2 days in LA, sitting in her living room, as that conversation developed, at a certain point she said, but you know what though, I'm thinking, man, it could have like this Kodachrome look, what you think? And she'd already told me, like, I already asked if we could shoot it in black and white, and they were like, hell no. And I was like, what? So, you know, so Ava already had already explored some things. I was like, Ava's so badass. I was like, wow, black and white would have been crazy. But she was like, I think we could do something like this. And she showed me these photographs. And I'd seen the documentary on the process of taking that those photographs. So I was really blown away. I love those images anyway. So as soon as she showed it to me, all it did is, like, reaffirm that we should just make the film. You know, we should be together, and there's no reason why we wouldn't make the film together. So. And then, you know, we took those photographs through the whole, from when we were viewing the images on set, we had a lookup table that was designed by an incredible colorist who piped it into our monitors, and we were actually able to light around the images. He actually took those images and helped us design the look, and then we carried that all the way into the finishing of the film. So those Fusco photographs are definitely the patina on top, but the sort of approach to how we did it was really just embedded in everything that David already designed before I got in the room with her, you know.
I just want to ask you one thing, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. But, you know, your career is so interesting. You had all these years as a publicist, and, you know, like you can't help thinking, wow, what if you could have made, like, all these films during that time. But in a way.
What a downer.
No, I know, but in a way.
No. Could have been making films all that time. What were you doing?
Well, what I was going to say, this was going somewhere else. I wasn't going to say that. So. But one of the interesting things in the way that you portray King is how sort of aware he is, the whole idea of public perception, and how he's sort of using perception and using, using publicity for a very good cause. I mean, I don't know if that's tied into your experience, but it's just, I think you're exploring this aspect of him in a way that I haven't seen.
I've done 999 interviews and no one's asked me that question.
Okay, just in time. We were going to get up
to
1,000.
No one's asked me that, so thank you. I think so. I mean, I don't think I've thought about it, but I'm certainly interested in, you know, how, you know, everyone is manipulating media right now. You know, your social media,
know about this in New York right now. Yeah,
we do.
Well, just what's happening in New York in the press with.
I'm not from here. I'm sorry.
Okay. It's local stuff. We won't
local
get into
stuff.
That.
But, you know, just who we present ourselves to be and who we are, even on social media. And that's been happening for years and years in traditional media. And so just that deconstruction of you know, the presentation of ourselves. And King was very much doing that with King, and all the movement people were doing that, this whole idea of, you know, the constructed image, respectability, all kinds of things that were at play. During the movement, but certainly the use of media to dramatize and illustrate, you know, the ills of society at that time. And so that's kind of the basics of it. But yeah, super interested in that, even so much so that, you know, that Bloody Sunday starts, you know, has a journalist right in the middle of it, kind of narrating that piece. It's important to, you know, bring that in. And I haven't really thought about how that's connected to my publicity background, but probably just because I'm fascinated by all that. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay, so let's open it up. Raise your hand if you have a question, and I can repeat. Go ahead.
Hi. excuse me. I'm very involved with this subject from a documentary point of view, and the King family legacy is known as a large hurdle in the documentary world. So what kind of cooperation or lack of cooperation did you have from that corner?
So the question, of course, has to do with the question about rights around Martin Luther King, like, history and the way his family controls the legacy. You know, it's known that you had to write different speeches for the film, So could you, yeah, I guess, could you talk about
that? They control
that?
His likeness, which we didn't use. And they, so in a documentary, that would be difficult. But we had David, and like, gain 30 pounds, brother. We ain't showing no pictures. And and then they control the intellectual property, the speeches. And so, yes, the speeches are all approximations. They're all rewritten to capture the spirit of King. Nothing that you heard there is real King. It's all faux King. But the question for me was really, of course I would have loved his speeches. He's, you know, one of the most amazing speech writers and orators of our day, or any day. But they were not available, and that was one of the big hurdles that it kept this film, a film with King at the center, locked away and unmade for 50 years since these events happened, and that just felt criminal to me.
For money, or why were they not cooperating?
Well, we never asked them. The rights, the cinematic rights to the work belong to another filmmaker, so they're just not available. And so, so no, it wasn't a squabble over it. It wasn't anything like that. We showed the film to the children of Dr. King out of respect, out of courtesy, but there wasn't asking of permission to tell the story, because this is not the story only of King. It's the story of a movement. It's a story about Selma. There are a lot of stories embedded in this. And so, out of respect, we showed all the living people who are named in this, the script, and told them this is what we're doing. And invited feedback and listened to a lot of folks, and you know, we're making the film in that spirit of service, really. But for us, as opposed to a documentary, the likeness wasn't necessary, and we did workarounds on the scripts. Excuse me, on the speeches.
Okay, over here.
I want to say two quick things and ask a question. I want to thank you for showing the human side of Dr. King. That's something that I think if it was done the way you did it, which is totally respectful, it would actually carry the long to a greater degree to the younger generation. As you said, that he's become, reduced to a couple of speeches and some legendary tales. Like, we really don't, people that are younger than me really don't feel it. And for you to put the congressman and the ambassador and Harry Belafonte, for you to actually show the living legends, and it helps us also because we know that we really have roots to the grassroots, the actual voice movement that is still alive. So I thank you guys for weaving that back into something that is so necessary.
My question was,
the portion of the church bombings when the children were killed, they were injected into the film. It was so dramatic. It was a dynamic that I hadn't seen in a long time. What made you do that in that way?
So the church bombings in the beginning, how did you decide to film in that way?
Lots of conversations. I mean, this was a big deal. The idea there, I was just really interested in putting you right in the place of how it felt to be in the Deep South as a black person. Really the state-sanctioned terrorism that was life there. How do I put you right there so that you understand what that is? And so, you know, the 1964 bombing of the Birmingham, 63 bombing of the, that was a church in Birmingham, not in
16th Street.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Gotta get an amen. So that was actually took place in Birmingham, not at Montgomery, but it was very formative, you know, obviously for the movement people. Diane Nash and James Bevel were very activated around that particular tragedy, and some of the early architecture of the Selma campaign came out of a direct result of that bombing and the murder of those four little girls. And so the question was, both from a narrative a standpoint of how do we pull you in and put you in the place of Selma, but then also, how do you do that? How do you, someone said, it was beautiful. But we weren't going for beautiful, we were going for reverence. You know, we were going for making sure that you heard their voices and saw their faces before, they were killed, making sure that you felt a piece of them before they were gone. And so, it was careful construction between Bradford and I, as well as our editor Spencer Averick, and trying to just really figure out what those frames were. We jump from the regular world of the film into this black box world where the girls move by, And you just see fragments of their clothing before Bradford's beautiful, beautiful crane shot. And so that was a lot of experimentation just to try to craft that and shape it in a way that was not a spectacle, but that felt emotional and that put you in the place.
And I read this one detail that you hear the girl's laughter right before the explosion, that you wanted to add that. Is that, you're looking at me like I'm making that up?
No.
Okay.
Everything you see in there, I added. Okay. Yes. But yes, I did it. But yeah, no, it was important to see them living alive, you know, talking about what black girls do. I used to be one, so I know. even what black ladies do, all we do is we like to talk about hair. It's very important, our hair. And so just, you know, that thing, my mother actually gave me that idea. I was talking to her, and I was like, what could I be talking about? You were a little girl in 1965, and I was looking for something that was 65-y. So I was asking her, what did little girls talk about in 1965? And she said, hair. I was like, oh, gosh, we do too. And so that's what came about. But I love those girls. I love that scene. You know, I love to see them alive again, you know, before they're gone. Because that incident, that tragedy, I think, is deeply embedded in the consciousness of all conscious people who believe in justice and dignity and know what a horrific thing that was. It changed so much to have just pure innocence taken. So anyway, that was our salute.
Can I just say something just because that's a real, I just want to kind of put it back on Ava a little bit, but you know, I wanted that question just sort of highlights really, Ava's giving you just sort of like the icing, but you got to know, this is a filmmaker that is really serious about communicating subtext in her films. She's very committed to that. And it's obvious. I mean, you see it if you've seen her other films, you know that. But I also want to say that like that those particular bits in the film where we see the black bodies sort of torn apart and put back together again, or torn apart and not put back together again, like, you got to know Ava is thinking about not just our condition, our sort of our political condition, but also like what our bodies have been through. Like, that's a really important gesture in the film. And Ava, something again that Ava said, listen, man, we can't just photograph these moments. We can't just think about these moments as just little girls dying. It has to be, it's deeper than that. Something more than that for us. We have to really digest. And this is a process of us only just seeing ourselves and dealing with many layers of things that we just don't have an opportunity to deal with on a daily basis because we're trying to feed ourselves. We're trying to stay out of the way of the police or whatever it is we're doing. So like that's a moment that actually repeats itself throughout the film. That's very much a thing that Ava came to the table and said, listen, man, like that moment has to really be a sort of a conversation, a piece about what our bodies, what the black body has been through in its existence in this sort of space. So I want to say that Ava's like, she's saying, oh yeah, we just photographed it, but really her obsession, her sort of like, I gotta work this out, Brad, was, I mean, it was relentless. It was no letting go. It wasn't like, oh, we're just gonna shoot this and then move on. She's like, no, man, that's not good enough. We have to figure out a better way to do this. And it was constant work. It was constant work. So I just want to say that, you know, not only is she just, only she did like wrote all the speeches in the film, which is remarkable, but like every bit of image, every bit of nuance in the image is like a well-crafted, well-meditated on, well, something that I know she's losing sleep over, and she really brings those things to us and says, listen, I've been thinking about it for like 25 hours. I need you to think about it for like another 40 hours. So work it out. And we need to, I just want to say that, just that it's not just, it's a limited time frame for her to have these things, but that's really her working on things.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Right down here.
Yeah, I have a question. And then you. About, when you look at this film, we could make a film about you making the film because there's a subtext going on with civil rights. You are probably having your own struggles, and then there's a civil rights movement while you work in an industry which is incredibly non-diverse, as many liberal industries are. So I wanted to ask you, as an artist, because you are artists and poets, how hard was it to make this film emotionally, to unleash the art in a way that I'm sure is very personal, but that didn't haunt you every night when you went to sleep? Because it did. I mean, I'm a minority, and when you see it, you cry. I mean, I'm sure you cried over some of these scenes when you watched them. How was it emotionally?
I hope you heard that in the back, because he said it so beautifully. I can't really. Any of it?
Well, it's a question about how personal. A little bit. Yeah.
Someone's nodding up there. It was. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
that
but the question is just about how, like, personally you took the subject, that the film was depicting struggles, and that you, as an artist, as an African American woman in an industry that's not so diverse, you know, how did you internalize what the film was about?
I'm going to ask you to answer that. I'm going to, but also.
I'll just give a small, very, very small short story. So basically, pre-production, we had our, as most movies, I've seen some filmmakers that I love in the audience, by the way, but.
Yeah, we're looking at you, Warrington.
We're looking at you, Warrington. So anyway, making films is a struggle, nonstop, constantly, relentless struggle. We get to the first day of the shoot, and the first day of shooting, we're shooting in the jail. We're shooting the jail scene. And there's a point in the scene that you hear what he says, they're going to, you know, they're going to undermine this movement. You know, they're going to take everything we have away from us. And that's the first day. A week goes by. It's every day. It felt like that. The characters are talking about that constantly. They're going to undermine this movement. They're going to undermine this movement. It just happened to be. So the conversations Ava and I are having on the side, like, they're going to take this damn, they're going to undermine this movie. That's sort of in our collective consciousness. That is what, those are the conversations. So anyway, by the end of the week, you know, we pick up the phone, we're on the phone with each other at the end of the way, we're about to go see dailies, and basically the conversation we have about making this film, it's not like this invisible existential thing, it's like human beings that come in the room to say that this is or this isn't happening, and we, you know, we have to stand together to sort of support and protect Ava's vision. Like, it just felt like it wasn't, it didn't seem out of the ordinary that what they were talking about the film is the same experience we were having making the film. And I don't mean that just in like, oh, we're filmmakers making a film. It's like, we are black filmmakers making this film about this man that we respect. We have to like walk carefully. We want to do it in a particular way. And I just felt like there were so many mirror things and it just couldn't help but see ourselves in the process of making the film, in the process of shooting these men and women, you just see yourself. You see yourself constantly. You're constantly having to like question your own sort of, you know, sort of space in that world. And so, I just think like the whole movie is a mirror of us. It's like, and it was apparent every day on set. I don't think there was a moment where we were just like, oh, we're just making a movie. It was like, damn, we're making this fucking movie. Like, that's crazy,
you know? For sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll just say briefly, I think every act of liberation is a struggle. And for us, this film and making this film was really, you know, an act of liberation. I mean, it is, like I said earlier, I said to him really early on, we're really gonna go for it. Like, we're not gonna kind of sugarcoat this. We're not going to do it in a certain way that makes certain camps happy. We're not going to not ask questions, not push, because I may never get the chance again. And I can't live with myself if we don't really try to liberate ourselves from an industry that says it's comfortable for you to only tell this kind of story in this way. And liberate King from this kind of marble encasement, you know, this kind of myth, this, you know, this deification, this, you know, this just talking points, top line stuff. And so it was really, everything that we were doing was very much a striving, and in anything like that, there's struggle. But when you do liberate yourself and you are able to show a film to an audience like this, I mean, you guys are like 6 feet long. It's like, it's so many of you and so many types of faces and types of people here. That is, you know, that is what pure joy feels like. And so thank you for the question and for recognizing the work.
Well, is that Darnell? Darnell Martin, who's made Cadillac Records, and I like it like that, speaking about accomplished
big
directors.
Fan. How are you, sister?
So, okay, mutual fans here. What's your question?
Move it along.
Oh, yeah.
And that tape is on.
Yes. Black people driving it right. Dark skinned black people driving it right, too. This was a master. Yes. No, I mean, thank you. Thank you.
That's a great review.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Thank you. She said you never told me no.
The driving scene night, maybe.
He ain't gonna tell me no. Be like, what?
Hey, I'm too scared, Ava. I don't tell. I look at somebody else and be like, no. But no, I'm not.
Okay, right. You were waiting, so right here. And no flash photography, please. Okay.
Hi. Ava, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Just so you know, I'm Joan Allen. I'm the associate publisher of The Daily Challenge and producer of Inside New York. I want to just say a second, compliment about the fact this is a powerful, extraordinarily important film. And I have two quick questions. One, getting back to the PR aspect. As I'm sure you realize from your old days, there are hundreds of black newspapers across the country. My paper is the only black daily now in existence. And one of the questions I have, which I'm sure you want to respond to, is how do we get more press response? We never got a press release, so you might have someone that may even be here that, we can get that. Because we want to get the information out. We've done as best as we can to reach as many people as possible, but for whatever reason, it's not.
Okay, I'll put you in touch with the publicist from Paramount, who's right outside.
I want you to talk a little bit about the civil rights movement then and the protests today and what similarities you see in terms of both of those movements.
Yeah, so if you could talk about the timeliness, comparing the civil rights movement's protest then to what's happening now, because you reference it in the film, as I said.
There's been some controversy. There was something about, I think it was misinterpreted about what Oprah said, and some protesters are pushing back against it, but that's not the impression I got from this film. So you
okay.
Want to elaborate on the similarities, you think, of these struggles?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're chronicling the civil rights movement, a time in our history where, the people made their voices heard in dynamic ways, that people came together of all kinds. It was African-American people and their allies from around the country, all classes, all creeds, all parts of the country, people came together. We see it happening again now. I mean, one of the big challenges for me, and I think I said on this very stage when I was here for Middle of Nowhere, was paramount importance of contemporary images of black people as I saw it. That I was tired of seeing the only films made about black people, or most of the films made about black people, as historical dramas or in a comedic context. And that there were very few contemporary dramatic pictures around black people, and that I was concerned for the black cinematic image, and why do we always have to talk about history? And blah, like, that was me 2 years ago, until someone says, want to do a movie about King? We're like, Wait, maybe. So, but I mean, that is still cause for concern for me, just the comfort of seeing you know, marginalized people in hindsight. It's much more comfortable. Mm. And so really that's why we were really trying to get outside of our comfort zone. What is a way to kind of, you know, get inside this history and making living and breathing and urgent and immediate and feel like now. And that was something that we were talking about before any of the unrest happened. We were very, very concerned with folks not feeling attached and connected to this history, because most of us don't feel connected to history. We don't know our history. We really don't. And so it was something we were always talking about. We wrapped in July. Michael Brown was murdered in August. You know, we have brothers being strangled. We have, you know, brothers being shot. We have brothers being terrorized, unarmed, a rash of things that happen. It's always there, it's ambient, it's always been around. But for some reason, in this moment, as we're cutting this film, all of that rises to the top of the pages, front pages of newspapers around, just not this country, the world, right? This becomes an issue where everyone is looking at the treatment of the black body and black men in America. What's going on? You could let it pass with Ferguson, maybe. You can say, we don't really know what happened. We're not sure. Did he have his hands up? Did he run? Did he rush him? We got the autopsy, but not sure. But we all saw a tape of a man strangled to death. All due respect. All my respect and my love to you. And we still, that's not enough. That's still not enough. So body cameras and the things that King did at the time of the civil rights movement, which was to dramatize and show the world the most ferocious racism he could on television so that people could be appalled. We can't do that anymore. We've seen it. We've seen it, and people are walking free. And so the question is, yes, there's a similarity to what's going on, but this is also very different territory that we're in. The same tactics can work some, but they need to mature, they need to blossom, because the opposition has matured and blossomed. And so I feel like Selma might have to offer, and I don't propose to know what it is for everyone, but it might just show some of the foundational ideas around the struggle and some of the tactics and strategies that worked. Some of them might still work. I know for a fact some of them won't. But you need to know your history in order to move forward. And this is movement history. This is activist history. This is progressive people's history. And if you believe in justice and dignity, you need to know where you came from. And this is a part of it. And this is what we offer.
And I know Warrington will want me to mention that on February 1st, he's organizing, we're working on a program that's going to look at this very subject, about the history of the image of the violent image of African Americans over the years and how it relates to what's happening right now. So we'll announce details very shortly, but that's here on February 1st.
That's so fantastic. Well, the film opens on Friday, and you know, opens wide. It's been open here for a while, and you know, I'm not worried about it, but I am curious about how, you know, folks will engage with. I don't know. I just want people to. I'm just curious. You know, will people connect it to what's happening now? Will people see anything in it that sparks an idea? Is this energy something that has propulsion? Does it have momentum? All of this kind of unrest that we feel. I mean, this was a 13-year-long. This movement was at its height for 13 years. Are we in a moment, or can this moment be sustained and be a movement? I'm very curious as to, you know, if this film can add to that conversation in any way. So I don't know why I said that. There's a man raising his hand. I don't know. Are we finished?
I think we know that. Well, I think we know the answer to that.
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, the film has already struck a strong chord.
Yeah, but beyond the film, just in talking about us as people.
What's happening.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting. And just to see this moment that was sustained for, you know, over a decade, you know, this can be more than a reaction that we're all feeling right now. It could be something that actually has, you know, some. You know, very rooted, foundational, you know, change. So it'll be for us to see and for us to make happen, I guess.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And I guess we are finished, but I'm sure you're going to come back in 2 years with a bunch of other films, and yes. You're always welcome back here.
Thank you.
And you too. And good luck with the film and the response to
Thank
it.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you for having us. Appreciate it. Good night.